Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I hope I'm succeeding, but what I try to do on a daily basis is to keep you informed and introduce you to interesting programs, arts, food, and cultural events, and to Vermonters who are doing something that you might find compelling. I have no idea where that will lead us from week to week. Today, we start off with a program that I think is definitely worth exploring. It's called the Co-op Seedling Grants Program, and it's administered annually by City Market Onion River Co-op. Joining me now to talk about this project is Mae Quilty, Assistant Director of Community Engagement for City Market Onion River Co-op. Mae, great having you on the program.
Hi, good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. How about you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Mae about the project, you can give us a call, 244-1777-877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Okay, so what are the seedling grants?
Yeah, so the Seedling Grant Program was started back in 2014 for us, and it was originally a way for folks who did not choose to cash their patronage refund check to donate to organizations doing great work in the community. And so it's been around for about 8 years now, and the focus of the program is to strengthen the local food system. So we distribute funding to organizations each year that are doing that in innovative ways. It's kind of an intentionally broad objective so that we can get a whole range of different projects. And the funding can range from $500 to $7,500 for any of the projects.
And you said it's going on now for 8 years. What are you trying to do or accomplish with these grants?
Yeah, so it's a really great way for us as an organization to really have a more statewide focus. A lot of our giving programs are really focused on the greater Burlington area, and this is one of those programs that we get applications each year from a variety of different organizations from all around the state. This year is a great example. We have projects in the Northeast Kingdom and Addison County in all different places, and they're all finding creative ways to strengthen the food system, whether that's increasing food access or finding job development opportunities in the food system, just a really great range of creative projects. And so the goal for us is to, as part of our mission and our global ends, is to support strengthening the local food system, but that can mean a whole range of different things for different organizations.
Mae, are there different categories, or do you just try to make sure there's some kind of variety in the programs that you give the grants to?
Yeah, there are not categories, but there are definitely a variety of ways that projects show up. So we'll have larger, more statewide organizations like UVM that sends in applications. And then we'll have organizations that are brand new that are kind of created out of a community response. So One of the programs this year is the Barton Community Garden, which is an entirely volunteer-led project in the Northeast Kingdom that's really working to grow food for their neighbors. And so that's kind of a one type of project. And then we'll have projects that are broader, that are really looking at statewide research opportunities, or an example of this year, the NOFA Vermont, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association, on their Abenaki Land Link project. And so we don't intentionally categorize different opportunities, but it kind of comes in different ways just because of the broadness of the program and the broad scope that we have. So it's been really, really great to see over the years the range of different projects that have come through, and the range of where they're located around the state as well.
Now, you mentioned they range generally from $500 to about $7,500 per grant. Yeah. But how much is awarded each year totally?
Yeah, so it changes every year. And part of that is because for the first 5 or 6 years or so, it was really based on what that number totaled in terms of folks who did not cash their patronage refund checks, which is a member benefit that we offer during profitable years. And so it's ranged, I think the highest was a little over 50,000 one year. And then when we expanded to our South End location and we had a period of expected unprofitability, we had to think about how we would choose to fund the program moving forward. We knew that we didn't want to have a pause in the program, and so we had to get creative, and we started a partnership with our Rally for Change program. And so for the past few years, it's ranged from $30,000 to $40,000. In 2020, it was $35,000. So that funding was distributed just this week. And then in 2021, it will be $35,000 as well.
And now when you talk about a period of unprofitability, that was because of the added expense of building a second location, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So it was planned for us, and so we knew that it was going to be a part of our process of expansion. And so what that meant is that for years, folks were receiving as a benefit of their membership, they were getting a refund back based on their spending that was determined by our board of directors. And that was only possible during profitable years. And so when we were not able to continue that program, once we expanded, we didn't kind of have the base of the funding for the grant program. Mm-hmm. And so we shifted to slotting into our Rally for Change program. So now it's a combination of Rally for Change funding and then co-op funding as well, depending on how much is raised through each of the allotted months in Rally for Change.
Outstanding. How many applications do you generally receive each year for these grants?
Yeah, it ranges. It's really interesting. I was looking at that this morning. So we actually thought that we would have a much higher volume in 2020 just with COVID-19 and and knowing how much of a need there was in the community. And so the application process opened last year in mid-March, really right around the time of the of everything that was happening, and was open for from March to June. And we ended up getting, I believe, 8 applications in total, which was a much lower number. And I think in retrospect, I think so many organizations were just trying to pivot and figure out how to approach the many challenges that came along last spring. And so we didn't see quite as high of a volume of applications. But back in 2019, we had 16 applications. Mm-hmm. So it really has been dependent on the year. I think it's ranged from 10 to 20 is probably on average over the past 8 years. And we're hoping that we get closer to that larger number this year as well, because it's always great to see the different projects that are happening around Vermont.
May, why is this something that is really important for the co-op to do each year?
Yeah. So we are, as a co-op, we're guided by our global ends. So we really are adhering to those. The global ends for us is really what you think of as a mission statement for different organizations. And one of the key components of our global ends is strengthening the local food system. And so we do that in a whole range of ways. And a big part of that is through working with local producers and local farmers, really supporting the local food system and movement. About 40% of our sales each year are to local and made in Vermont items. We're really proud of that, kind of keeping that money in the local economy. But one of the other great ways that we do that is supporting projects that are happening elsewhere that we may not be spearheading, but that we can support. And so this program was really developed to be able to say, how can we continue to strengthen the local food system, work with organizations that we may not already have relationships with that may be doing really interesting things to support farmers, to support our agricultural landscape, food processing, farm-to-school movement, all of these different components that we may not be quite as actively engaged in, but that we're supporting in a number of different ways. And so this program really encompasses so many of those goals and allows us to kind of develop new relationships with organizations and think about ways that we can engage further with some of these. One of the great examples from this year's projects is Acorn Vermont, which is the Addison County Relocalization Network. Their whole project is about creating an online market to connect producers and buyers and really just thinking about some of the ways that these projects have potential impact down the road to support up-and-coming farmers or new food producers who can find creative ways to continue to build strength in our food system. So it's really a great program for us.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it's been going on for 8 years, and we're going to get into more of the new grants that have just been awarded. But can you talk about maybe a few from the past that people would recognize and see, have had an impact in our communities?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, there's so many to choose from.
just a couple for now. And if we have more time, we'll go into the other, 24 that you want to talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the ones that is really neat for me has been Salvation Farms, which is a 2016 grantee They're an organization that was originally based in Morrisville, but they ended up expanding to a food processing facility in Winooski. And their project was really great because it was the Food Hub Workforce Training Program. And they really had a dual focus on, you know, having a way to process local food efficiently and get it out to institutions, farm to school, get it in the hands of folks. But it also was a job training opportunity. So it's really a cool way to kind of have that combination of different goals that we see. Another one is the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf, which is now called Feeding Chittenden, their farm stand project, which is a way for them to highlight and showcase local produce and really kind of have an interesting kind of shopping experience and feel more like a farmer's market. We've done the Intervale Center, some trail extension work with them, but also work on their kitchen so that they're able to do more processing and kind of build their ability to have more on-site events and kind of open people up to some of that. We supported a Burlington High School food science class with some work to grow microgreens, which was really neat. Done some great work with the UVM Foundation, and some other ones that come to mind are United Way, community health centers of Burlington in the past couple of years. Really a really cool range. And then lots of partnerships with schools as well.
And I love that you mentioned Salvation Farms. Teresa Snow of Salvation Farms, the first person I ever heard talked about gleaning. And so I always do credit them for, right, educating me on gleaning and, you know, the food that's the vegetables that are still left out in the field that the farmer can't harvest. And they invite the folks from Salvation Farms to come in to take that and make sure it gets distributed to those in need. A really great program. May, are there specific criteria that you look for in awarding these grants?
Yeah, so the application process, by the way, opens today. So I can mention that. It's open through June.
Okay.
So we would definitely love to hear from organizations. So we do require nonprofit status, and we have a whole range of different kind of application tips and logistics on our website. And there aren't too many stipulations. We really try to keep the scope of the program broad. But we do ask that it's not focused on personnel costs or existing operations. We're really looking for creative, innovative ways to address existing needs in new ways. And so oftentimes we'll either have a brand new program that an organization is looking to launch, or they're trying to kind of adjust an existing program to meet a new need or a change in what they're seeing. And so looking for kind of creative ways to offer a chance to expand existing programming or create new programming.
Now, you teased me with one earlier that really intrigues me. I think it was a NOFA program, the Abenaki Land Link Project. So please tell us all about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the NOFA Vermont project was definitely a favorite of the grant committee this year. So I should also mention that a group of members of the co-op actually review these grants each year and recommend funding to our board of directors. So it's a really great way for community members to get involved in ways that they may not be in their kind of day-to-day lives. But this was one that definitely stuck out to the grant committee, just really focusing on cultural preservation and knowledge and seed saving. Really great program, and it's actually the highest funding that we offered this year. We offered $8,924 to the project. And this project is really neat because they were able to do, basically the funding gets distributed this week, actually. And so while the application process opened up in March of 2020, the funding distribution is in March of 2021. And so a lot of the projects are kind of looking at timelines that are a little farther out, which was particularly challenging with COVID. Mm-hmm. And the Abenaki Land Link project was great because they were piloting the project in the 2020 growing season. So they had 15 sites around the state where they were having partnerships with the Abenaki Nation to offer specific seeds to different project partners to grow. And then the goal is to have kind of community processing days and ultimately have harvest celebration and all these different pieces that, again, may have to pivot because of COVID-19, but really offering a way to preserve these foods that are native to the Abenaki people and continue to grow that as we head into the 2021 season. So they're actually, in this season, they're looking to expand the number of grow sites, I believe, to 30. And then they're partnering with tons of different organizations around the state and different farms to be able to grow these seeds, process, and begin to learn from one another, which is really great.
Oh, that's brilliant. Now, I want to go back to a past recipient, one that intrigued me, and it is called Milk with Dignity. Can you tell us about that program?
Yes, absolutely. I have to brush up on that one. I think that was a 2019 grant.
I think you're right.
Or 2018. But yeah, they were doing some really great work. They were doing research and focusing on health and safety in the workplace on dairy farms, and they received a $7,500 grant award, and it was the Milk with Dignity Standards Council. So they work directly with farms to make sure that health and safety standards are being met and being upheld all around the state. And so a lot of work in Addison County with the dairy industry, but the funding was specifically to help them to offer these trainings that would be provided and be provided in a variety of different languages to Spanish-speaking farm workers specifically on dairy farms. And then they would also work with different partners to make sure that they were meeting all of the state guidelines and really helping to evolve in that way and monitor. I think there was a specific focus on air quality and housing for farm workers. But yeah, a really great way to to support the dairy industry in a different way and to make sure that workers are being treated fairly as well.
I love hearing about these individual programs that you have awarded grants to, because it really does give an idea of the diversity of people who can apply, or organizations that can apply, so they don't think, this isn't for me, but it really could be for their organization, right, May?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the great things about every year when we see the applications trickle in. You know, we've had applications from the city of Winooski. We've had applications from the Howard Center, from larger organizations, from more kind of startup organizations. The New Community Project, one of this year's recipients, is a newer organization. And so kind of that response that we're talking about really responding to a community need in different ways can look so different. And it's really, really cool to see, especially over the stance of the program now that it's been operating for this long. There's such a diversity in different partnerships that we've been able to support.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another one of the recent recipients. You want to highlight one of those?
Sure. I'd love to talk about the Acorn Project, which is the Champlain Valley Food Shed. This one is really great because, again, it's focused in Addison County, where we don't quite have as much interaction just because we're based in Burlington. And it's a really cool example. So many times part of the application, we ask, you know, what are some other partners that you foresee being a part of this project? And the Acorn Project is a great example of that, because they've really thought out working with different retailers and farmers and producers. And they're really looking to connect producers with buyers to help farmers to get their products into stores, to help people get access to some of those things. And they're partnering with Hope, the food shelf in that area, which we've also given a seedling grant to in the past. So that's great to see. And they actually were able to pilot in 2020 a free app that actually people can access now. It's called the Eat Local app. And that's been a really cool way to kind of get the project started. And then moving into 2021, they'll be focusing on creating an online platform. And it's just such a great example to see kind of the way that responding to community needs can change over time, and especially with COVID-19, the online piece has become so crucial. So really great to see the way that they're able to kind of think ahead and be able to start making sure that people are able to connect and create this online farmers market and interactive maps and ways for people to connect in new ways.
May, I want to go back over, you mentioned that today is the opening of the new grant season, and so I want to make sure that organizations know the details on that. So first of all, when, you know, do they need to apply by, and where do they go to start the process?
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for asking. So today is the opening of our 2021 cycle. We'd typically be celebrating with an in-person event, so this is year two of us kind of pivoting to an online way of spreading the word.
Hey, so this is the event, you and me, we're the event today, this year?
Yeah, we have, we did a video as well. But yeah, so we're really excited. We submitted a video that's posted on our website. You can check it out on citymarket.coop/seedling grant. And it's a video that highlights all the 2020 partners. So if something piques your interest, you can hear more about different projects. You'll hear from Secretary of Agriculture, Anson Tebbets. You'll also hear from me about the 2021 cycle. And on that, at that same link, you'll see the application for this year. And we're accepting applications through June 25th of this year. So got a few months to kind of think about it and think about what might work. And I'm always happy to chat with people. I've had tons of great conversations over the years with people saying, you know, I don't know if this project is a good fit. I want to ask a couple questions. Mm-hmm. And always happy to do that and make sure that folks are set up for success when they submit their application.
All right. May we have time for probably a minute and a half to tell us about one more of the recipients from this year?
Oh, okay.
See. Put you on the spot.
It's hard to pick.
I know.
Let's talk about 350 Vermont, their Rewild Vermont project. This one's great, too. I think, you know, we've talked a lot about the diversity of projects that are showing up. This one is really focused on kind of the intersection of climate justice and food justice and the ways that there's so much opportunity when we think about soil health and carbon sequestration to have so many overlaps with food projects. And so this one was really exciting for us to see because we don't really think of 350 Vermont as a food-focused organization or an ag-focused organization, but this project is part of their Put Carbon in the Ground campaign, and it's really focused on planting fruit and nut and native trees all around the state and in the Burlington area, so even in more urban areas, and then partnering those plantings with workshops for folks to kind of have a better understanding of what that looks like. And so it's really focused on kind of the opportunities for food to be a way to preserve the climate and to really think intentionally about how we're growing food. And then there's also a component of food access. So the food that's going to be grown by these plantings will also be available to the community. And so there's kind of this dual goal of addressing food insecurity and also addressing climate change.
May Quilty is the Assistant Director of Community Engagement for City Market Onion River Co-op. May, thank you so much for being on the show, telling us about the program today.
Thank you so much. This is great. I hope to chat with you again soon.
I hope so. All right, let's pop out for a CBS News update. Then we're going to return to learn about the women's suffrage movement in Vermont. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall-winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Yesterday, I spoke with St. Michael's professor Catherine Dungy about the role of the Delta Sigma Theta sorority in the women's suffrage movement. Today, we're going to go a little broader in looking at the movement, and we'll also focus in on what was happening in Vermont. Joining me to guide us through it is Vermont historian Lynn Blackwell. Lynn, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, if you've got a question, a comment about the women's suffrage movement for Lynn Blackwell, give us a call, 244-1777-877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Maybe you had a relative who is involved in it, want to tell us their story. We'd love to hear that as well. Lynn, let's not start at the 19th Amendment in 1920. I want to start earlier. So when did women's suffrage, when did that movement really begin?
Well, on the national level, it is often marked by the 1848 convention of women in Seneca Falls, New York, where they wrote the Declaration of Sentiments, which was the first public expression of women's desire for a variety of rights, that also included the right to vote.
And would we have had some representatives over there from Vermont at the time?
We did not. We had only one woman who had been brave enough to begin writing about women's rights. She was Clarinda Howard Nichols from Brattleboro. She was a journalist, and she wrote extensively about married women's property rights, because at the time, women who married were not able to control their property. Their husbands were in charge of all their property, even if they owned it before they married. If they were single, they were able to, but very few women were single at the time. And she had been abused by her husband, so she wanted her own property rights. And then she also began advocating for the vote when she realized it was very difficult to change the laws without the vote. And she was the first woman to go in front of the Vermont legislature in 1852. She addressed the legislature asking first for the right to vote in school meetings, because she thought, well, if I could just get one first entering wedge into the franchise, then perhaps we could get more voting rights after that.
Say her name again, because it really should be remembered here in Vermont.
Clarinda Howard Nichols. Yeah, she's the first woman and very well known both here and in Kansas, where she eventually emigrated because she decided that she could do more out there in the West than in the East, which she felt was quite conservative.
It had to be radical thinking for someone to suggest that women should be allowed to vote. I know it sounds really crazy, but back in the 1840s, 1850s, it had to be, you know, just absolutely radical thinking. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. And I've searched and searched for more women who were willing to become colleagues of Nichols, and there were just no one in Vermont that was at least speaking publicly about it, even though they might agree. She did find women, of course, in Massachusetts, and she was very much supported by the women of the first National Women's Rights Conventions. But the problem was that women weren't even supposed to speak in public in front of men. So she had to carve that pathway first. That she had to request that she speak in front of the legislature, and men had voted had to vote whether she should be allowed or not. So it was very unusual for women to even have political opinions. And to go into that world where only men were able to operate was just scary. So it was very radical for women to come out and say they wanted to enter that arena, which was considered sort of the dirty pool of politics.
Let's take it a little more globally. And we talked about the 1848 Convention of Women in New York State here in the U.S., kind of the starting point. So how about internationally? Was there anything happening? Were there any progressive thinking countries that actually did the unthinkable and allowed women to vote earlier than the 20th century?
Well, there were a few. In fact, during the French Revolution, the idea that women could be equal partners in government was first sort of discussed. But there were none in Europe, and the first national government was New Zealand that enfranchised women, I believe, in the late 19th century. So, yes, it was very unusual.
I want to ask this before we go too far, because I don't want to use the wrong term. I'm never quite clear the difference between suffragette and suffragist. I think they have different meanings or different usages. Could you explain that so everyone knows which is the better to use?
Yes, that's quite a bone of contention. The suffragettes were the women in Britain. And they had begun advocating for the right to vote and used fairly radical tactics. They had actually gotten into some not just nonviolent protests, but breaking of windows and breaking into government buildings, and that was considered extremely radical and violent. So when Vermont suffragists realized that this was creating a backlash to the whole woman suffrage movement, they did not want to be labeled suffragettes. But in the U.S., when people who were opposed to suffrage, particularly men who were opposed to suffrage, they labeled our suffragists suffragettes in order to outcast them as radicals. And so the suffragists in the U.S. were determined to be suffragists, not suffragettes. And in fact, our most famous suffragist in Vermont was a woman named Annette Parmalee from Enosburg Falls. And she had to educate the men that she was not a suffragette because they began calling her the suffragette hornet because she was buzzing around the legislature lobbying for women's suffrage.
Wow, she must have been something. And that's just one of many things women have had to educate men about all through these decades and centuries. What were some seminal moments in the movement in the 1800s? We mentioned the convention.
Yes. In the national movement?
Sure, we'll start there.
Oh, of course you had the Civil War was a tremendous turning point. And when the 14th and 15th Amendments were passed, the 14th giving, due process and equal rights to all Americans, and the 15th giving the vote to African Americans, the woman suffrage movement was determined to include women in the Constitution. But that was a turning point because it didn't happen. The one half of the suffrage movement just was so distressed after the Civil War that women didn't also get the right to vote along with African Americans that they split into two different sections, one going forward with only women's rights, suffrage and other rights for women, and others sticking with the program of pursuing more rights for white and black women. And that was a major problem, a source of contention within the movement. And that was a turning point. The next turning point would not be until the 1910s, really, when the suffrage movement gained many more diverse members, including working class women, African American women, Asian women, all sorts of women came out to begin protesting publicly and educating the public about the injustice of disfranchising half the population.
And in the 1800s, I mean, you mentioned Clarinda Howard Nichols and Annette Parmalee, but did things start to percolate as the century went on in Vermont? Was there anything that happened that really kind of started to allow or motivate more women to speak out publicly about this?
I would say the percolation was very slow and sputtery. In fact, it pretty much died out. One milestone for us was that the right to vote in school meetings, which Clarinda Howard Nichols had promoted in 1852, was finally achieved nearly 30 years later in 1880. And what was interesting here was that it was the women who were opposed to drinking and had organized into the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the well-known WCTU, who actually
I'm still a member,
right.
By the way. Joking. Go ahead.
They were determined to get the proper instruction in schools for young people to teach them not to drink. And so by the 1880, the legislatures finally agreed, well, maybe that was a good idea. But then they only allowed tax-paying women to vote.
Hmm.
So that meant only about 15% of the women could vote because they didn't own property and they weren't on the grand list. Their husbands were on the grand list and were never assessed a property tax.
Hmm.
So that, it was very slow, and really the next milestone in Vermont was not until 1917, when Vermont women were tax-paying women were allowed to vote in town meeting.
Wow. And let's go to the phones, and we've got Stephen calling from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I have a question for Lynn,
mm-hmm.
and that is whether there's any, you know, we're talking about radical thinking, and I know there are many people in this country, younger people, who are very intelligent, younger women and men. And in terms of radical thinking, what about having younger people get the right to vote?
Excellent question, Stephen. There have been pushes. I know we allow someone to vote, I think, in a primary if they're going to turn 18 by the time of the general election. Lynn, we saw a couple years ago when they had the vote in Scotland to divest from England. They allowed 16 and older to vote. Any thoughts about having younger people being able to vote?
That was not an issue during this time period. Of course, at that time, the Vermont Constitution allowed voters who were 21 to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And nationally, that was changed to 18 in 1972, I believe, by constitutional amendment. As you mentioned recently, there's a thought of the people who are going to be 18 can vote.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a movement right now, at least not in Vermont, to look at the question of youth, younger people voting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not aware of that, but there may be nationally.
Yeah, I was excited when it did happen back in 72, when they made it younger, and when I turned 18, probably one of the first things I did was to make sure that I got registered to vote. Couldn't wait to get into that voting booth the very first time. Pretty exciting stuff. Yesterday, I spoke with Professor Catherine Dungy about the Women's March in Washington in 1913. How big was this in the overall suffrage movement at the time?
Oh, this was an incredible moment because the women, of course, were the people, the men watching it, were quite rough,
mm-hmm.
and this made a spectacular display. Exactly what Alice Paul, who had was leading the movement at that point, or this aspect of the movement, had wanted to have happen. One of the interesting things is that we had a woman who was also marching in that parade.
Mm.
Her name was Lucy Daniels, and she was from Grafton. And she had been very frustrated with the slowness of the Vermont movement.
Mm-hmm.
She was a friend and correspondent of Annette Parmalee. She went down to the movement in Washington and marched. In fact, she wrote Alice Paul, the head of the organizing effort, and asked her to recruit more black women to be in the parade. And that didn't happen, she was in favor of everyone being a voter, and particularly working-class women and African-American women as well. She was well-known in Vermont because she wrote a slogan on her barn, a square deal, Votes for Vermont Women, that gave her great notoriety. It was pictured all over the place, and she was told that she also protested by not paying her property tax. Now, she was a single woman, so she owned property.
Wow.
And didn't pay her tax. And then the selectman tried to sell off her property.
Oh, boy. Well, as we did learn yesterday from Catherine Dungy, the women of Delta Sigma Theta, the 21 women of Delta Sigma Theta, did march in Washington in that march in 1913. So there were some African-American women present as well. That's really great. What happened, though, Lynn, in those next 7 years from 2013, that march, which was, again, a seminal moment, that resulted in the 19th Amendment in 1920?
Oh, a tremendous amount happened. Well, first of all, there were many states in the West that had already provided women with full rights to the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
There were at least 11 states in 1917 when Vermont passed the town meeting vote, and New York in 1917 also passed full voting rights. So that was a big moment when one of the big eastern states passed voting rights. There were two major organizations, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, led at that point by Carrie Chapman Catt, and there was the National Women's Party led by Alice Paul. World War One was a major turning point because at that moment, the National Association decided to put aside suffrage for the moment, advocate for patriotic Americans, participate in the war effort. Alice Paul, on the other hand, protested President Wilson's refusal to support suffrage wholeheartedly. And she and her protesters went and stood in front of the White House during the war, challenging the president with big placards, how long must women wait for liberty? And Lucy Daniels from Vermont was one of those women. They were put in jail for peaceful protesting. And this was really one of the first nonviolent protests in American history. And, of course, Daniels was then really notorious. And people vandalized her home in Grafton, calling her a jailbird. And the women were many women were very upset about this radical nature of this protest. But Congress finally approved the 19th Amendment after the war when Wilson, at the moment when the war was the peace settlement, in 1918, the Paris Peace Conference was completed, supported the suffrage as well at the national level.
And
so that was a turning point. And Jerry Chapman Catt had been very helpful in lobbying him and getting that done. So there was a tremendous amount of upheaval over woman suffrage at that point in time.
And Lynn, very quickly for clarification, 1917 Vermont women could vote at town meeting day, but did they get full voting rights not until the 19th Amendment in 1920?
No, they didn't. Well, they did get it in 1920, but Vermont never ratified. and that was the most interesting thing. Vermont didn't ratify the amendment until 1921.
Oh, my.
Because our governor, Percival Clement, refused to call a special session of the legislature so they could do that.
Oh, boy. Lynn Blackwell, I want to thank you for taking the time to share the history of the women's suffrage movement nationally, internationally, right here in Vermont. This has been very interesting.
Well, thank you as well.
We're going to take a break now for CBS News. Then we'll be back to national correspondent Bob Ney. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Time to turn to national correspondent Bob Day to get an idea of what happened this week while we were all involved in our lives. Bob, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Bob, we always start off with the COVID numbers. I'd like to do that. Are we are we headed in a positive direction?
Well, we're doing much better than your conversations with me months ago. Yeah. So, you know, it's as far as the total confirmed cases, 30-some million cases, and the total deaths are 546,000 in the United States. And we've tested 385 million. Now, we obviously have a population of 350 million. A lot of people have been tested multiple times. So testing's out there. The death rate is much better than, I mean, nobody wants one death, but it's much better than it was, obviously, a few months ago.
Where are we looking, you know, heading as far as being able to vaccinate people worldwide by the end of this year?
Well, this is yet to be seen because there's 12 billion doses of 13 different vaccines that can be available by the end of the year. That would be enough, Rick, to vaccinate 70% of the planet, which would be great. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what about the variants that are coming up? You know, in Africa, they've had particularly the variant outbreak. And I, as I understand, in parts of Africa, some areas, nobody's been vaccinated. And then also unpredictable manufacturing, getting the supply out to people. A lot of countries have had a take care of themselves first, and that's understandable. But at some point in time, especially for the third world, and if we want the whole world, obviously, to be vaccinated, which we do, then we're going to have to eventually export vaccines. So they're working on it. But there's also, I know I've read statements where, you know, there's very possibly, Rick, people that aren't even going to be vaccinated by the end of 2021. So they've just got to keep at it, and the world's going to have to get involved in it, including the United Nations.
And how much has these blips with AstraZeneca, the thoughts of it causing blood clots, also the information that they submitted to the federal government that used outdated information, how much does that set things back?
Well, I think it does. You know, there was a great hesitation on AstraZeneca and what it could or couldn't do and its effectiveness. And so I think that, you know, had some setback, obviously, you know, in the process. And again, we also don't know, are there going to be, you know, some new vaccines that, that come out there? Mm-hmm. Obviously, the one shot is going to be easier to deal with than multiple. And then there's the issue, for example, on the shot I got with the Moderna. You know, that is a case where, you know, you have to get the second shot. I think that had to be, or maybe it wasn't Moderna, maybe it was Pfizer, had to be kept at minus 91 degrees.
I believe that was Moderna, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right. So that, yeah, that made it very difficult to get it to rural places, for instance, where the Johnson & Johnson hopefully will fill that kind of gap, right, Bob?
Oh, that's right. I mean, Johnson & Johnson should help. It didn't, and Moderna itself didn't have to have the cooling capacity, you know, as the Pfizer did, which was, again, minus 91, which is a lot. And you go to parts of the third world. I travel to India, for example, quite a lot, and there's just certain areas where having it transported and maintaining that temperature would be quite impossible.
This was a big week for President Biden, held his first news conference. So how do you think it went? What did he cover?
Well, I thought it was very interesting. Number one, he seemed a little bit hesitant, and I think the reasoning behind that is he didn't want a gaffe or a faux pas, and then all of a sudden that became, frankly, Rick, the story of the day. That's number one. So, you know, he was he did have some questions written down, and his, and some of his people had, you know, had some questions written down. But I don't think that's a big, big deal. Presidents do that. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very interesting that one of the national media outlets instantly said, are you going to run again? Now, you know, they might as well have just came out and said, hey, we hear conspiracy theories. You're going to step down and make Kamala Harris the president. Mm-hmm. I mean, why didn't they just do that instead of, you know, I thought that was a ridiculous question after 64 days. Are you going to run again?
Yeah.
That seriously was, I don't know why the media even attempted to do that. But he did take a couple of subjects to the back burner, which is guns and immigration, because he, you know, right now I don't think wants to get into specifics. So he focused more on the vaccines and, you know, and the economy. But overall, I mean, he got through it. By the way, Rick, I don't think you're, from what he said, how he said it yesterday, and from the indicators in the White House and friends of mine in the press corps, I don't think you're going to see a lot of press conferences. I really don't.
Interesting. He waited 2 months, which seems like a long time for a president to do so. Is that? Or?
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, and it was, Rick, because when you think about it, you know, with all that's going on, with the virus and things, and you know, and different things have happened in the country, obviously immigration beginning to surge at the border, yeah. Shootings, you know, you would think, okay, maybe he'd have a press conference in between, but they waited. I think they waited, the White House is the day, on purpose to just say, hey, we are not going to react with press conferences all the time. And so I think you're going to see far less with President Biden.
Well, you brought up immigration, the border situation. What's the latest going on there?
Well, this is very interesting. You know, I dealt with it for 11 years when I was in Congress with the issue. I've been to the border. I've watched it over a couple of presidents now, Obama and Trump, you know, as a reporter for the news. And now I'm watching President Biden, who has, you know, a whole different set of issues that are now recropping up, which is, you know, the families, detention, what do you do with them? And I thought it was very interesting that just last week, Homeland Security said, hey, the border's closed except for children. Otherwise, they are actually turning people around at the border. So that's happening. And something, Rick, that was so underreported at that news conference, which shocked me that nobody followed up on it. And they asked President Biden about this terrible story about this poor little 9-year-old boy. And it's a very heart-wrenching story, and you know, separated from his mom, and he's here. And they asked him, and the president basically said, well, he has a mother, which is very interesting answer to that, you know. So I think it's, let's stay tuned and see what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Let's turn to foreign policy. There's been a few big stories there as well. First of all, it seems that President Biden certainly trying to stand up to China, which seems to be coalescing our allies.
This one's a big deal. The first president in modern history to actually do what he said he would do was President Trump. Everybody said, I'm going to fight China, you know, and then they didn't. Mm-hmm. They really didn't. But President Trump did. And I know that creates controversy when it happens, but he did it. And he set a whole different example of how we are going to approach China. Now, what's interesting is Biden comes in now, and the end result is Biden keeps Trump's tariffs. All right. He says, oh, we're going to form coalitions. So right now the approach by President Biden is to form a coalition with Europe, you know, as an alliance of ours to, you know, fight China or, you know, be aggressive with China. So President Biden has not undone the Trump policies, basically. Mm-hmm. He's taking a cautious approach to it, and he's taking a tough approach to it because, let's face it, Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, you know, four key states over this very issue.
Right.
Bernie Sanders and Trump were the same thinking. Bernie Sanders, you know, was on trade, is very, very good about, you know, standing up to China. Hillary wasn't. And now you have President Biden, and he's got to be careful because if he is viewed as not aggressively undertaking this, he could lose some key states the next time.
Yep. Another big move was restoring aid to Palestine.
Mm-hmm. That was very, very interesting because Trump administration had cut the humanitarian aid. So President Biden's restoring the money. And the way he does it, he doesn't give a direct check to the Palestinian Authority. These go through what's called NGOs, non-government organizations, for food and medicine, you know, Catholic Services Relief, for example, different NGOs that are over there. And he added, the president added $15 million more dollars for coronavirus vaccinations, which is needed because they've been very, very slow in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So he restored what used to be, you know, the policy that we had.
And he's really trying to get the Taliban and the Afghan government to sit down and make nice because he really wants to get out of Afghanistan.
longest war in our history, and he says they'll be out by next year, but they're not going to make the May 1st deadline that Trump had. It's a little bit of a gamble, because if violence starts up against our troops, that could cause us to further escalate, but I think his intention is to get out of there, but I just don't know if he can get out as quick as May 1st. But I just can't imagine that he would keep troops in there after the end of this year.
All right. And, Bob, proof of your brilliance, it is the Pfizer vaccine that you mentioned that is the one that needs to be much colder than Moderna. 90. So props to Bob Ney for getting that right. National correspondent Bob Ney, as always, I want to thank you so much for bringing us up to date on what happened this week.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Vermonters are rolling up their sleeves and getting Moderna and Pfizer vaccine shots. Johnson & Johnson single-dose vaccinations should follow at some point. We're rolling. But are we doing it right? That's the question 7 Days political reporter Colin Flanders looked at in this week's edition of the paper. He's here to tell us what he learned. Colin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What progress has the state made on getting us vaccinated?
So the state has made notable progress to date. I mean, we have already completed the first dose for 83,000 people. I think recently we eclipsed the one-third mark for the entire population. And if you think about this, looking back, I mean, it's only been 3 months. We look back to December when we first were getting these doses. So we have made notable progress to date, and each week we're making more progress as more our supply continues to grow. I think if you're just looking at some of the numbers, I mean, over 100,000 people have already been completed, 85,000 people have been started. So we're getting there. Just the question is how much time do we have until some of these other factors come into play?
And one of those factors is indeed the variants, which has shown up in places around Vermont. This might just be a rhetorical question, but will we be able to get ahead of the variants and get Vermonters vaccinated before they really take hold?
And frankly, I think that's an open question. I mean, we don't know at this point, and I think the we're seeing each week how this race is playing out. So every week we get closer to vaccinating the majority of people, the better, obviously. But like you said, the emergence of these variants is really raising the stakes. They're proving to be far more infectious. I think one of them that's here is 50% more infectious. The other one's 20%. Meanwhile, our case rates are remaining stubbornly high, and so it's sort of creating this perfect storm as we're heading to the finish line. It's going to be a photo finish, I think.
And we've been somewhat assured by the drug companies that these will take care of the variants, but have they really been able to test that and know for sure that there's a certain amount of efficacy?
Yeah, I think those studies are still ongoing. When you think about how long it took to prove that the vaccines were useful against just the normal strain. So obviously it's going to take some time, but I think early estimates are showing that they're still holding up, though there is concern that they might not be as useful as they were against the first coronavirus, as we think of it.
Your point is a good one about how long it takes to do the testing and get approvals. Read in New York Magazine column a few weeks or months ago that we did have some of these vaccines January of last year, and but they still had to go through all the protocols before they could be approved and rolled out with good reason to the public. So is there a fear I'm going to go to the other side from vaccines to restrictions. Is there a fear of turning that spigot, lifting the restrictions too much, too early before we've vaccinated enough of us here in Vermont?
There is definitely a fear. And I will say up front, to be clear, that Governor Scott has continued to take a highly conservative approach, especially compared to some of these other states where they're considering lifting mask mandates and really turning the economy back to the level that we saw before the pandemic hit. At the same time, the emergence of these infectious variants and the fact that our case counts aren't dipping to the place that we would like to see back in the summer, for example, there is concern that we might be, even the little turns might be might be sending the wrong message. I mean, recently we've allowed unvaccinated households to gather. We have also opened up bars. And these actions are inevitably going to raise the risk of transmission. I think that's just an objective fact that if you're engaging in these behaviors, inevitably there will be a higher risk. I think at the state level, the concern is that the longer the restrictions stay in place, the more mental health impacts and economic impacts you're going to have. So it's really a balancing act. The experts that I talked to seem to agree that we really won't know what the right balancing act was until it's all over.
Hmm. Why are the daily caseloads remaining so high in Vermont and the Northeast?
Yeah, so there's a few theories about this. I mean, one of them is that in Vermont in particular, we have been very successful overall controlling the virus compared to other states. And that means that we have a lower natural immunity in Vermont because essentially we've had fewer infections. If you think of a pot of people that can be infected, Vermont's pot is bigger than, say, South Dakota, where they were experiencing multiple thousands of cases per day back in the fall and winter. A second contributing factor is just the fact that Vermont's population is so much smaller than a lot of other states that smaller outbreaks here represent larger blips on the radar. For example, that the ongoing outbreak at the Northern State Correctional Facility, as one expert put it to me, that can really alter the graph of cases here, whereas a couple hundred cases in, say, New York City wouldn't even be a blip. So those are two main examples that I've heard from a lot of people. But there is one other thing that people have been talking about, and that's our vaccination approach as well might be contributing to it.
All right, let's talk about that. I mean, could we have rolled out the vaccines more effectively?
Yeah, and I think this is a huge point of debate, and it will probably never get resolved. I think the Scott administration has held firm that their chief obligation is to preserve life, and so that's why they've been giving priority to people who are most likely to die. When we think about the elderly and those with chronic conditions, and they say that we just haven't had enough vaccine supply to spread it out further than that until this point. That's why we're slowly opening up new age bands. And they say the age banding approach is the best way to do it. It's the quickest way, easiest way to understand, and it's going to get everyone vaccinated faster. On the other hand, there are people out there who believe that this approach lacks the nuance that we could have taken to ensure that we are both protecting people from dying and protecting people from getting sick. I talked to one expert from Dartmouth who argued that the vaccination strategy really suffered from a tunnel vision where we're focused so heavily on preventing death that we're not stemming sources of transmission that are occurring in high-risk groups, and therefore we're allowing the virus to spread more than it otherwise would have. Again, this is a balancing act, and from the state's perspective, they think they've done exactly how they should have.
So what groups should or could have possibly been bumped ahead of the line in favor of some of the age band groups?
Yeah, I think the main group is most likely frontline workers, these people who don't have the option to isolate themselves. I mean, when I think of myself in particular, I have rarely had to go out into the real world. I mean, I've done a lot of my job from my desk. I grocery shop. But there are people out there who don't have that privilege to isolate themselves like that. They have to be at work every day. Maybe they're a grocery clerk, or they're doing some other job, or they're interacting with the public all the time. I mean, as the one expert put it to me, infection rates are primarily driven by needs that are unmet. It's by people who are needing to be places rather than being places that they want to be. Another example is prison inmates. I mean, we've just seen an outbreak almost reached 200 people at the Newport prison, and I think a lot of people have been looking at that and saying, well, they're among the highest groups in Vermont. Why haven't we targeted them? We could have avoided that potentially. There are other groups out there, but what the Scott administration has rightfully said is that there are many groups that could be given priority, and they've been hearing from all those groups, and so they felt that, in fairness, that the best way is the age-banding approach to cover everyone.
The teachers is another group that took a long time before they were given the go-ahead to get the vaccination.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, you could go down the list. I did see a list at one point of all the requests that the Scott administration has seen, and it's it's almost mind-numbing to consider all these competing interests. At the same time, I think there, at least in the eyes of some experts, there are a few clear groups that pose the highest risk of transmission, and should we have vaccinated them, they think so.
All right. Now, once people are vaccinated, will they really want to keep on doing all this unfun stuff that we've been doing for a year? The social distancing, you know, the hand washing, the mask wearing. I mean, come on, man. You know, aren't they, once you get that, that vaccine, aren't you just going to say, that's it, I don't need to behave any longer?
Yeah. I mean, I think that'll probably be up to every individual. I mean, I would love to stop wearing masks and doing some of that behavior. I think to me, the more interesting question heading into the next few weeks and maybe a couple of months is the decision before Phil Scott is really, should we be restricting activities because we understand that more people could get sick? We've been talking about death so often that one UVM infectious disease specialist put it to me, we're really entering this new gray area where we're not only weighing the risks of transmission against the well-known ramifications of this isolation we've been feeling, but we also must consider how willing people are to adhere to these rules when lives aren't hanging in the balance. I mean, when we're thinking about long COVID, for example, is someone more likely to follow the rules if they think they're protecting someone from perhaps getting sick for a long period of time and having some uncomfortable symptoms, or are they more likely to follow the rules if they think that perhaps their grandparents or someone else's grandparents could die? I mean, it's a totally new philosophical balance we're trying to take. And I don't know. It's a tough one. I don't have the right answer.
But you did look at, excuse me, long COVID, and because it's something that we don't talk a ton about. What did you learn about that?
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the main incentives for keeping case counts lower than they are now is that we're still trying to figure out why certain people suffer from these lingering symptoms and how many people it occurs in, what percentage of cases. Estimates widely vary, but I picked out one workshop from the National Institutes of Health that suggested anywhere from 10 to 30% of infected people go on to have some lingering symptoms. Some of these people have actually seen their symptoms disappear once they're vaccinated, but many haven't. And I mean, based on that estimate, I put this in the story. If you had a thought experiment, think of the next 2 months, we continue having 100 cases a day. If 30% of those cases go on to become long haulers, that's 1,800 new long haul cases. And that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people in the state who are developing a new chronic condition that we don't know much about. And personally, I mean, I would not want to be one of those people who are dealing with this. The symptoms are pretty brutal at some time. So this is what we have to consider as we're moving forward and trying to protect people that, sure, deaths and hospitalizations may be on the decline, but there's still a lot of unknowns that we probably don't want to be taking the risks on.
It's interesting. All of last year, we kept saying, you know, we can't really tell of, you know, when someone would say, well, can we open up, you know, next April or next summer? And it would always be, well, we won't really know. Can we play the baseball season, whatever? And we're now in March, a full year in. And as you said, we still don't really know. There's so many questions about this virus and how it affects us, and we'll just keep learning about it as it goes on. Colin Flanders is the political reporter for 7 Days. I want to thank you so much for being with us this morning, Colin.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Take care.
And listeners, you can find Colin's story in this week's 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Let's take a break for a CBS News update. We're going to return to learn about LunaFest. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z-Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. We're still not able to all hang out together in packed theaters. Who knows when, if that will happen again. No worries, there are still plenty of great things to stream and enjoy right in the comfort of your own home. One is happening this weekend, and it benefits a great organization. Maisie Howard is the Director of Development and Communications for Vermont Works for Women. She's here to tell us about LunaFest. Maisie, so glad you could be with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Rick.
Our pleasure. First of all, tell everybody, what is LunaFest?
Well, LunaFest is a traveling film festival of short films that are made by and about women. It's a festival that's put together by the Luna Bar Company that you might see in the supermarket, the energy bar company that's designed and marketed specifically for women. They, about 20 years ago, actually decided to create a program that they would give out to any organization working towards any kind of women's issues. So in our case, you know, in Vermont, we work on economic justice issues for women, but it can be hosted by any organization across the country, and the films every year are absolutely fantastic. They're short films made by women filmmakers from around the world, and they change every year, so there's always something new to see, and they're always extremely, extremely wonderful.
Has this been an annual event for Vermont Works for Women?
It has been, yes. Not for 20 years by any means, but we've run it for the last 3 years consecutively, and then we also had hosted it before in the early 2000s. So we love the event. It is a wonderful way for us to bring people together and learn a little bit more about what we do, but also to view these wonderful films. Obviously, this year is a little bit different, so we're dipping our toe into the water of virtual streaming, but we're also excited about that opportunity.
All right, and are you familiar with what people are going to see? You want to share maybe a short or two that people you think will enjoy?
Well, I haven't seen the films yet myself because we haven't had access to the films, but every year they put together a different slate, and typically the films are, some of them can be very short, like maybe 2 minutes or 3 minutes. I think the longest is usually about 10 minutes, and the full runtime is about 86 minutes, so it's about an hour and a half or not even quite that. And I know that the program for this year includes stories about women making a trek to the North Pole, an all-female expedition to the North Pole. There is a short film about immigrants to the United States at the border, and a variety of other films about some artists and other creative women out there. So it should be a really interesting slate of films this year. I'm looking forward to seeing it tonight with my family.
Oh, excellent. And there is one with a local angle called The Scientist versus Dartmouth, so that'll be interesting to check out as well. So how do people go about this? I know the virtual streaming is new to you all, but it's even, probably less or more of a mystery sometimes to us as we try to navigate it. So what can you tell people about how they'll be able to watch these films?
Yeah, so it is different, and every different event runs, it seems like everything runs on a different platform, which could be a little discouraging sometimes. But the easiest way to find out information is to go directly to our website, which is vtworksforwomen.org/LunaFest. And there you'll see all of the ticketing information that you need. The platform that it's being hosted on is something called Eventive, which is a platform for virtual screenings of film festivals of all kinds, and LunaFest is being hosted on this platform. And, it's pretty simple to go in. You don't need to enter a lot of information, but you do need to create an Eventive account. You purchase the ticket right through that platform, and then you'll get a link when the films are available. So the films are being screened this weekend, starting tonight, Friday, at 7 p.m., and they'll be available through 6:59 p.m. on Sunday evening. So you can buy your ticket now, and then you'll get a link later this evening saying your films are available to screen, and then you just go back to your account and log in, and you can get started watching. You can also purchase a ticket, you know, tomorrow afternoon if you decide that the weather really is pretty crummy and you want to watch the films then. Mm-hmm. You can still purchase them at that point. And my understanding is that Eventive does connect to all of the major, you know, streaming mechanisms that people will watch films. So you can watch it on your Roku or your Apple TV and things like that. And there's information on the Eventive site for all of that. They have a very good help section that gets you right all the information you need to get it on the big screen if you want to.
And once I buy a ticket, I can decide to start and watch it at any given time, pause it and go back to it.
Yep. When you start watching the films, you have 24 hours to complete that watching. So, okay. You know, if you're not planning on watching every single one of them at the same time, just remember that because that link does expire after 24 hours. But you can definitely get going whenever you feel like during that weekend.
All right. That sounds great. Now, let's get back to talking about Vermont Works for Women. You gave us a little bit of an explanation, but what is and what do you do at Vermont Works for Women?
Well, Vermont Works for Women is a nonprofit. We're based in Winooski, and we've been around actually since the late 80s. Our mission is to help women and girls recognize their potential and explore, pursue, and excel in work that leads to economic independence. So what that means, you know, boots on the ground, is that we work directly with women who are trying either to get back to the workforce, to make a change in their career field, or find in some way financial stability. And, you know, that's a big job, and we do a lot of different programs, you know, related to that. We also work in the women's prison. The one women's prison in Vermont is in South Burlington, the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, and we're one of the contracted service providers there to help the women who are approaching reentry into their communities to really find, you know, employment and find stability in their communities once they've transitioned, because that is shown to be a huge reason why people do not go back to prison, because they have employment and they have stability. So we do a lot of work with that as well. And we have youth programming, because we realized, you know, about 20 plus years ago that it's all well and good to, you know, create these different job pathways for women, but if we're not inspiring the younger generations to really pursue career pathways that are going to be financially viable for them, we're not doing our full job. So we have summer camps that are called Rosie's Girls that we run in communities around the state. That's a trades and career exploration summer camp that's a ton of fun for middle school girls to explore different fields that they might be able to get into as they think about, you know, training and school down the line. And we also do a lot of work with the technical education centers and high schools on other career exploration work. So lots of different programs, but it's all work that relates in some way to financial and economic independence for women.
That's great. I want to get back to LunaFest again. I think you have some special treats that people can order for their screening.
Yeah, so we teamed up for this screening with a local business called Local Maverick. They're a sort of new startup. They started just probably in the last year or so. And their website is a virtual farmer's market. So it's a way, especially now during COVID, where you can't go necessarily to a farmer's market, you might not feel comfortable, or maybe they're just not happening. This is a way for you to go and support local producers and local vendors who are creating, you know, delicious different kinds of produce, baked goods, canned goods, all sorts of wonderful stuff. And so Local Maverick has actually curated a few different specialty boxes that you can purchase from them through their website, which is also linked on our LunaFest page. The fun thing is, you know, they're kind of movie snack related. So there's one that's just sweets and it's cookies and fun things like that. So so they're a wonderful, wonderful group, and you can still order some of those boxes. I believe there are still some available, and you can order them for pickup in Burlington tomorrow afternoon.
All right, and to make the movie viewing even more exciting. And one more thing, Maisie, I think this summer This is going to show outside.
Yes. So we're very excited to be able to go back to the drive-in. Last fall, sort of on a whim, we pulled together a drive-in screening at the Sunset Drive-In in Colchester, and it was a huge success. I mean, people were really excited to have an event to go to because, you know, as you know, we're all so isolated, and having something that is completely COVID-friendly, everybody's still spaced out in their cars, but being able to gather and do that was a lot of fun. So we'll be going back to the drive-in on June 3rd. Hopefully by then it'll be warm and, you know, not too rainy, but we're looking forward to going back to the Sunset Drive-In and doing another screening. It'll be the same film because it's the same, you know, the same slate for the entire year. But if you miss the viewing this weekend or you're, you know, more interested in going to the drive-in, that's available too.
Very exciting. Maisie Howard is the Director of Development and Communications for Vermont Works for Women. Maisie, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. And listeners, to learn more again about LunaFest, vtworksforwomen.org/LunaFest. Always in the mood for talking about potential guests or subjects, you can let me know. I got to register for my first COVID jab yesterday. That was registering. Anyone else go through the process? We can chat about that. We can share your experience if you already have gotten a shot or two. Love to hear what that was like for you. We can talk baseball, the Sox, high school sports. Any thoughts on how things were handled at Harwood with the boys' hockey team's coaches? Also, you can boast about your high school if they're in the state finals or if they just won one. You can brag away. We'd love to hear from you. Did you win a state title when you were in high school? I don't think I came close. I was on the soccer team. We were a club team for a few years, but we were rubbish after that. I don't even think we made playoffs. There was one high school when they would play us, we were like their cones, you know, the cones you put out for soccer players to dribble the ball around. That was us. We might as well have just worn orange. Okay, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You have probably ascertained that I was... I loved sports, but I was a pretty, average to poor athlete. Did my best. All right. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. If you want to hop on the line and chat, well, we have a few more minutes here, probably about 8-9 minutes of open phones here at the end of the week. And, where are we going to go first? We've got, going to go to Brookfield, and Jeff is there. Hi, Jeff. What do you got for me?
Hi, I just wanted to give you some good news. You had an early show about apprentice programs, and then on Common Sense Radio, someone called in asking about the future of Global Foundries. And Global Foundries has started a manufacturing technician apprentice program with Vermont Tech, and they've got 25 people in it now. They plan to graduate about 300 over the next 6 years. They're paying $18 an hour. They're getting a free college education. It leads to an electrical engineering degree from Vermont Tech. So I would say if they're making that kind of investment, it's a pretty good sign they're going to be around for a while.
Wow, that's great news, Jeff. Now, how do you know about all this?
I coordinated for Vermont Tech.
Oh, well done. Yeah, that apprenticeship, registered apprenticeship program for the state, we talked about earlier this week. And if anyone's interested, we do put the podcast up. It really is a great option. If you're not sure that, you know, you want to go to college, you want to learn a trade, there are, I think it was something like 38 different occupations that you can look at, right, Jeff? And you coordinate with either CCV or Vermont Technical College. You get some in-class learning, and yeah, boy, that sounds great. And I love the way you've kind of looked at that going forward. Not only is it a great idea that this is an apprenticeship program, but what it could mean to the future of Global Foundries here in Vermont.
Yeah, and really the big difference with this one is that Global Foundries hires you. So you're hired, you're working full-time as an apprentice in their mechanical maintenance division. So you're getting a good salary just off the get-go. Then you're taking the college classes through Vermont Tech to get your electrical engineering degree, and then you move into an engineering track when you graduate. So it's a huge investment that they're making. So as I say, the guy that called in for on Common Sense was kind of concerned about the future of GF, but I would say it's a pretty good sign that they're going to be around a while.
Oh, that's outstanding. And, Jeff, I know they can go to the Department of Labor website to find more information, but can they find this at VTC's website as well?
You know, they actually should just email me directly at jhiggins@vtc.edu, and I'll hook them up.
Give me that again, J Higgins.
Yep, HIGGINS@vtc.edu.
All right, great. I'll keep that around. People will probably email me or call in the future. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Okay, take care.
Great call. jhiggins@vtc.edu if you're interested in that apprenticeship program connected to Global Foundries. That's great news on a Friday afternoon, isn't it? Love that. What a way to finish. But we still have the open phones for a few more minutes, 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. And, again, open phones. We can talk about what it is that you enjoy talking about. That was a great call relating to an interview we had earlier this week about the apprenticeship program through the Department of Labor, CCV tied into it, and VTC. And so really is an outstanding way to learn, to you know, wind up with a great career that you'll be trained for through the apprenticeship program. These are registered apprenticeship programs overseen by the Department of Labor. And that interview, again, was the result of a listener letting me know about it. I had no clue. No clue about that program. And a listener wrote in, and I was happy to schedule that interview. All right. As I'm waiting for your calls at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255, I had my age band came up yesterday, so I was able to register to get my vaccination. And I actually was trying to do it. I don't know if I should tell anybody this, but I was trying to do it while I was on the air. I was hoping to let people know yesterday morning because it started at 8:15 and I was doing the morning show. I tried first through Kinney and Kinney Drugs, and the one place that I could find that I could go was in Virgin's. And by the time I got everything completed, my time was gone, and all the times were gone at that at Kinney's. I tried Walgreens, same thing. So I did go through the state site, the health department, and you register. It doesn't take much. Trust me, no difficult questions to answer, no hoops to jump through. It's pretty standard stuff. Probably takes, I don't know, 5-ish minutes, and then you can pick your site and time, and I did. And so I'll be going to the old JCPenney's in Berlin in a few weeks for my first shot, which is pretty exciting. Let's go back to the phones. And are we going to Newberry? Is that Fred in Newberry? How you doing, Freddie?
All right, Fred.
Yeah. Hi, Fred.
Let's see here. The possibility of solar farming could be more profitable than dairy farming in New Hampshire. I think that could be in the not-too-distant future.
Why you say that, Fred?
Well, dairy farming is really complicated. I mean, you have to have a lot of people. You've got to have veterinarians. You got to have feed. I mean, it's just too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But a solar farm would be a lot less complicated. He'd lease his land out to the solar company. The solar company would pay him money. And he could, retire and have a good life.
Yeah. Is this something you're hoping happens for some of those dairy farmers in New Hampshire?
The big problem with it would spoil the look of Vermont. That's the problem.
Yeah. And we have seen, the point is well taken, that so many dairy farms, thousands, have closed, since the 1920s in Vermont. And each year, I remember a few years back, Fred, when we went under 1,000, it felt like, oh my gosh, that was a benchmark, that really signified we're losing dairy farms in a great way, and we are. Many of these fields have been converted to solar farms, and so it's smart. There's the sun. Let's capture that and use that for energy But one of the great selling points, especially to visitors to Vermont, is that rural charm, right, Fred?
And those... Yeah, that's true. The rural charm does have a good draw for Vermont. But if you go out into the Great Plains, I mean, that's a golden opportunity out there.
I mean,
you know, a wheat farmer might be able to make more money than growing wheat or soybeans in Ohio.
It's quite possible. And, of course, rooftops that we have done nothing with, another good place for solar panels. Who knows? It might come to that solar farming does indeed nudge out dairy farming here in New England. All right. That'll do it, Danny. It's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. As I always say, send me topics, send me guest ideas. Always happy to hear about them. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. We've got the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference following CBS News. And I'm Rick Singeri. I'm going to meet you back here on Monday.